You're studying for an important exam, and you may be able to take a pill, and suddenly you have a photographic memory. That may be a reality sooner than you think. New skills may be inserted into the memories of the unemployed, or to bypass the need for study in doctors and lawyers by inserting whole bodies of knowledge into their memories. Think what it could do for talk show hosts. Scientists can now read thoughts circulating in our brains and can insert a chip into the brain of patients who are totally paralyzed and connect it to a computer so that through thought alone, they can surf the web, read and write emails, and perhaps one day in the distant future, the mind will be freed of its bodily constraints and roam among the stars, as several scientists have suggested. Those are just a few of the fascinating items in Michio Kaku's new book, The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Power the Mind, and it's what we talk about this hour. He is a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, and he is co-founder of String Field Theory. He's the author of many books, including Hyperspace, Beyond Einstein, Physics of the Impossible, and Physics of the Future. And we welcome phone calls for him, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Michio Kaku, thank you ever so much for being with us. This should be fun.
Glad to be on the show.
Yeah, nice to have you here. You're right, and this is a fascinating fact in itself. We have learned more in the last 10 to 15 years than in all of human history. Is that true?
That's right. 15 years ago, the very first grainy images of the brain were emerging from MRI scans. Today, we have crystal clear pictures of the brain with thoughts ricocheting almost like a ping pong ball across the brain. And we can then begin to understand how the brain constructs consciousness, how it actually moves and controls the body. So what was once considered science fiction, telepathy, telekinesis, uploading memories, we can actually do rudimentary forms of all of these science fiction feats in the laboratory today.
Isn't that something? That is just remarkable. And you started thinking about some of these things when you were just a kid, right? You were trying to move objects around the room with your mind?
That's right. I used to watch Flash Gordon on TV when I was a kid, and I was hooked on science fiction with starships and aliens in outer space, and also telepathy. And I used to watch on TV telepaths like the amazing Dunninger. And I thought to myself, well, why can't I do it? And I would try to experiment trying to read other people's minds and thoughts. Well, I failed. And I came to the conclusion that I was not a telepath. And however, one day when I became a physicist, I would be able to understand the devices which would allow us to probe the inner thoughts. We can now probe right there into the mind, and even though we cannot cure mental illness, we can actually see how mental illness forms. We can begin to understand how to connect the mind to a machine so that we can move household appliances around us. And in the future, when we walk into a room, we might mentally simply control all the computers in the room, change the lights, the temperature, make phone calls, surf the web, all done mentally.
Isn't that remarkable? And you say early in the book, I know your mom suffered from Alzheimer's disease, and you mentioned Einstein, whose son suffered from mental illness as well, that our work in this area could lead to tremendous advances in the field of mental illness, couldn't it?
That's right. Mental illness is one of the oldest afflictions affecting the human race. Even the Bible mentions mental illness, for example. And we can now see what happens in a person's mind when they start to hear voices, for example. That's schizophrenia. And many of the homeless people we see talking to themselves on a cold night, they're schizophrenic. Now, the left part of your brain generates words when you talk to yourself. That's how you talk to yourself. However, we see that part of the brain, the left temporal lobe, lighting up in schizophrenics without their permission, without their knowledge. Now, think about that. If one day you hear your thoughts of yourself ricocheting in your mind without your permission, you'd think you're crazy, right?
Right.
Well, that's what happens. We can actually see that now in the brains of people who are schizophrenic. Now, we cannot cure schizophrenia, but we now understand how it functions to a degree. And President Barack Obama, that's the reason why last year at the State of the Union address, President Barack Obama announced the BRAIN Initiative. That is, the European Union and the United States will allocate over $1 billion.
Wow.
That's billion with a B, not an M. $1 billion to understand all the neural pathways of the brain. And the most immediate outcome is to understand mental illness.
Mm. In order to understand and do some of the things that we've described here, does one have to be like you and become a theoretical physicist?
No. In order to have these enormous powers of telepathy and telekinesis, you just have to be a willing subject. For example, Stephen Hawking, a colleague of mine, the famous cosmologist, he has lost control of his vocal cords and even his fingertips. He cannot communicate anymore. So scientists put a chip in the right frame of his glass. Next time you see him, look at his glasses.
I will.
You'll see a chip. And that chip is connected to a laptop. It picks up radio from the brain and then deciphers that, and he can type to a degree using this device. And if you put a chip directly on top of the brain, you can actually have that person control a wheelchair, type, surf the web, write email, answer email, do crossword puzzles, control household appliances, even control a mechanical arm or leg.
Hmm.
And that's why the military has devoted millions of dollars to the Wounded Warrior Project, which will allow veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan to have the gift of motion once again after an arm or leg is amputated. These people can now mentally control a mechanical arm, giving them the ability to handshake, to do a high five, or pretty much anything you can do with your arm.
And tell me, how does that happen? I mean, can you explain that so that I, who I'm not a physicist, can understand how does that happen?
Yeah, here's how it works.
Yeah.
They put a chip about the size of a dime right on top of the brain. They have to, unfortunately, drill a hole in your head, but you don't feel anything because the brain has no pain sensors. Then there's a wire that connects that chip to a laptop computer, and then you ask the patient to move your arm to the right. When you move the arm to the right, it energizes a chip, and it's recorded. That motion then corresponds to moving your hand to the right. So the next time you mentally issue that command without moving your arm, the computer now knows that it's a command, move the cursor to the right. And so that's why when you think move your hand to the right, the cursor moves to the right. In the same way, you can type. You can learn to use all the ABCs that make up the alphabet. And you can also surf the web this way and answer emails. And eventually, you're quite good at it. It's like riding a bicycle. It takes time to get used to it. You can do pretty much anything that a normal person can do on a computer. That's amazing.
Yeah, that is completely amazing. And speaking of computers, you've talked about how computers, and I'm not sure what this means in the future, that chips will cost a penny, the cost of scrap paper, and computers as we now know them will disappear. They will be everywhere and nowhere, ubiquitous yet hidden. What does that mean?
Well, we think of a computer as being big, bulky. Think of back in the 1950s when a computer for the military filled up an entire floor of a building, right? Now we have these little chips, and even they will begin to disappear into the cloud. So in the future, when you walk into a room, you will mentally access the cloud. Now, the cloud is the Internet, except all the heavy-duty calculations are not done on your cell phone, not done in your laptop. All the heavy computations are done in a server hundreds of miles away on the Internet. So your cell phone becomes sort of like a faucet that taps the water in the reservoir, so you don't have to carry the water on your back. And so when you walk into a room, you'll access the cloud, which is the Internet, and tell the Internet, move this, turn on the lights, turn on this computer, I want to listen to this music. And you'll do it simply mentally. So the computer itself will disappear. Just like, for example, electricity. Electricity today has pretty much disappeared. It's very cheap, costs only pennies. And you simply turn on the light switch and energize the whole room. In the future, you'll simply think and energize a whole room of computer chips because chips will cost less than a penny in the future.
What are we going to do with all our free time?
Well, we'll still have to create things. We'll still have to do things to earn our keep. There's definitely That's definitely true.
Yeah.
But I should also point out that when I was a kid, I used to love watching the movies. And the movies, in some sense, give you an insight as to what could happen. Now, Arnold Schwarzenegger was in a movie called Total Recall, where he thought he was the good guy. And throughout the whole movie, you think he's the good guy. But at the very end of the movie, you found out that he's really the bad guy. And he had good guy memories implanted into his brain to make him think like the good guy. And so the question is, once we have the ability to upload memories, what happens if you upload good memories and become a genius at mathematics, or upload false memories and you think you did certain things and you really didn't do them at all? That could have enormous society implications.
Well, who's doing the uploading?
Well, it turns out that this was once considered science fiction until last year. Last year at Wake Forest University in North Carolina and also in Los Angeles, the first memory ever was uploaded into a mouse. Hmm. The mouse was trained to sip from a bottle of water, so it learned that task. Then it forgot that task over a period of time, but they recorded the memory. And then they inserted the memory back into the mouse, and the mouse instantly remembered to sip from this bottle and how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
At MIT, they even inserted a false memory into a mouse. Next are primates. They want to insert memories into primates, so the primates will already know certain tasks without having to teach them these things. And so in the future, it's not inconceivable that we'll one day push the play button and learn calculus. All the courses that we flunked in college will be able to pass using this device.
So would we have to go to school? Because you could have your memory for everything, right?
Well, one impact on the economy would be for workers who have to learn new skills. Many times workers are thrown out of work, and they're not retrained for the next generation of technology. However, it's possible that we might be able to upload a lot of these skills so that workers laid off in one area could then seamlessly go into another area with these memories. Now, of course, this is still science fiction, but the very fact that we can even upload a memory at all is absolutely incredible. And so the secrets of memory are now being revealed for the first time. For example, some people have seen the movie 50 First Dates with Drew Barrymore. Mm-hmm. She forgets the date after the end of the day, and you have to woo her again the next day for 50 dates. That's what Adam Sandler had to do. That's based on a true story. There was a gentleman years ago who had an operation, and they damaged his hippocampus, which is the memory organ of the brain. When you shook his hand, he would shake your hands and be glad to meet you, and then forget the fact that he just met you, and he'd have to shake his hand all over again. Mm-hmm. He would relive that same day over and over and over again.
Yes, yes.
It's true. There really is a part of the brain that controls memory.
What about this pill that you can take? Because this would have all kinds of ramifications. A memory pill, and suddenly you have this photographic memory. Are we close to that? Is that part of what you were talking about when you talked about what they're doing with mice? And what are the ramifications of that?
Okay. Well, the concept of photographic memory has been part of lore. I mean, people have talked about it, legends. But now, for the first time, we're taking these people and putting them in brain scans to see exactly how is it that they have such fantastic calculational mental abilities. Some of these abilities were attained by accident when there was an injury to the left part of the brain. One person had a bullet as a child. Bullet goes through the left part of the brain. Another person hit his head on a swimming pool floor, diving. And both of them started to exhibit these fantastic mathematical abilities. If you go to Kennedy Airport in New York and you look up at the international terminal, you see this huge mural, it's about 100 feet across, of New York Harbor. It was drawn from scratch by this gentleman who was in a helicopter, took one ride over New York Harbor, and drew the entire harbor from memory.
All the windows
on buildings, the skyscrapers, everything from memory. It's astounding when you see that mural. So next time you land in JFK Airport, look up and you'll see that mural. Anyway, it's possible to induce this kind of memory. However, we don't quite know where you have to hit yourself on the head. So after today's interview, for God's sake, do not hit yourself on the head thinking that you're going to get these fantastic memories. However, we think that the brain records everything, like a tape recorder, but it then has another program that allows it to forget. These people apparently forget the forgetting process. They forget how to forget. And therefore, if you were to ask them, what did you do in 1957, May 3rd at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they'll tell you what they were doing. It's amazing.
That is amazing.
Our brains have this ability, but it's not good for us because we're paralyzed. Many of these people have, you know, very low-class jobs. They're haunted by all these memories circulating in their brain. So I think that we learn how to forget for a reason so that we can focus on the task at hand and not be paralyzed by memories of what we did 30 years ago to the day.
But wouldn't it be nice, I'm sure you've said this, although you're a brilliant guy, maybe you remember everything, but I frequently have thought, I read that book. I remember reading that book in sophomore in high school, and I can't remember it. And if all of that could come back, all of that useful knowledge that we learned in all of these science classes and all the literature we've ever read, will this memory pill bring all of that back?
Well, we're now understanding the biomolecular process of forgetting. We now realize that forgetting is quite complicated. We once thought, the prevailing theory just a few years ago, was that forgetting is nothing but atrophy, you know, rusting. It dies down with time. That forgetting is the normal process of the brain. Now we realize that's not true. It turns out that you have to learn how to forget. The brain has to consciously forget all these different memories, erase the tape. But for some reason, these people, the erasing mechanism is broken. And we're now beginning to understand the biomolecular nature of the erasing process. These people cannot erase memories. They simply stay stored up
them.
In the brain.
All of their memories. Wow.
One gentleman memorized 15,000 books and could recite line for line. This is Kim Peake. He passed away a few years ago. He was the basis for the movie Rain Man. And he could memorize 15,000 books. And if you were to ask him what was on line 15 of page 350, he will tell you.
Right.
Like that. Absolutely amazing.
That is amazing. Michio Kaku is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. We should tell you that he's going to be in Milwaukee on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at Boswell Books. The event is free. It's open to the public. The store, because it's such a fascinating topic, and he's all over media, too, including The Daily Show, I think, this week. They are going to be closing the doors for the duration of his talk if they reach capacity and then reopening them once the signing has commenced and people have begun to depart. So you need to get there early to hear the talk, and you'll still have a chance to purchase the book and join at the end, but the doors will be closed while he's speaking, which is the polite thing to do. We'll welcome phone calls from Michio Kaku. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. He's a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, co-founder of String Field Theory, and the author of several books, including Hyperspace, Beyond Einstein, Physics of the Impossible, and Physics of the Future. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Michio Kaku. His latest book is The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. And let's go to Matt in Sparta, our first caller for you. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for having Dr. Kaku on your show. Very, very cool to get the opportunity to ask my question. And my question is, in his opinion and the general consensus of the scientific community, when is the earliest possible time frame for singularity to occur?
What does that mean, singularity?
Singularity is the time at which humanity will have the technology to upload our minds to a device, a computer, or whatever it would be at that time, basically allowing our consciousness to leave our body.
Oh. Of course. Something as simple as that. Dr. Kaku?
Well, President Barack Obama and the European Union are dumping $1 billion, as I mentioned, for the BRAIN Initiative, which is to map all the pathways of the human brain. The short-term benefit of this is a way to handle a mental illness. We'll be able to understand why the brain is miswired to give us bipolar syndrome and schizophrenia and OCD. However, there is a longer-term perspective. Once we have BRAIN 2.0, that is a CD-ROM with all our neural networks and neurons on it, in principle, we can live forever. And in principle, our consciousness is now divorced from our physical body. Because if you were to then activate this CD-ROM, it would have all your memories, all your personalities, and in some sense would be a carbon copy of you. So even after you die, perhaps this thing will keep on going. Now, there are different versions of the singularity. Some people think the singularity is the moment when machines become smarter than us and then have progeny, that is, children who are smarter than them, and they have children that are smarter than them, and you have an escalation, an infinite escalation of super smart machines that then take over the universe, okay? So that's one version of the singularity. Another version is the one he mentioned.
Right.
However, I still think that we're decades away. I don't think it's going to happen by 2025, a date that some people have mentioned. The human mind is much more complicated than we thought. And the BRAIN Initiative of President Barack Obama, it's not meant to be finished until maybe mid-century, by the time that we have a complete readout of all the neural circuits. Now, remember that when the Human Genome Project was successful, that changed the course of medicine. Today, it's impossible to talk about medicine without first mentioning the Human Genome Project. In the same way, we hope that the BRAIN Project will completely change the landscape of mental illness and Alzheimer's and dementia and even learning, because we'll be able to upload memories of how to do calculus. All the courses that we flunked when we were in college, we can learn by pushing the play button of a computer. Mm-hmm. So I think that perhaps late in this century, when the BRAIN Project is finished, then we can entertain thoughts of perhaps living forever, of consciousness outside our body. And some people have advocated shooting it into outer space on a laser beam, in which case we could explore the universe at the speed of light. Consciousness would then be freed of any booster rocket or space suit, and we would send pure consciousness into outer space to explore the universe at the speed of light. Wow. This is no longer totally out of the question.
And then how do we find out back on Earth what we discovered out there?
Oh, we would have to have a relay station, which is previously built, and then your consciousness will be downloaded into a robot called a surrogate or avatar. And so your consciousness would then energize a robot, and you can then move and perform duties on this distant world. And then they would send the information back to Earth.
Do you ever get the feeling, Dr. Kaku, you were born a little bit too early?
As Doc Brown once said in the movie Back to the Future, I would like to live beyond my years. That is, to see into the future. Because as a physicist, I know that I probably will not live to see the day when we have starships or warp drive or the ability to manipulate wormholes. Now, I can calculate on a sheet of paper the energy necessary to bend space and time and to create wormholes. But it's also an energy that I'm not going to see in my lifetime. So that I find a little bit depressing. However, who knows, maybe part of our consciousness will survive even after we pass away, and maybe a piece of us will be alive to witness warp drive.
Oh, well, I sure hope yours is, because if anybody deserves it, it's you. Whoa, let's go to – thanks, Matt, for your call. Paul is next in West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good afternoon. Doctor, our brain is an electrochemical device, and it has different subsections, one being memory, and each brain is different memory retention. But let's assume for the moment, I just caught the tail end of your statement, you uploaded advanced calculus into the memory. But what happens if your processing center, the ability to synthesize and to analyze and to turn it into to make calculus being an operating system to solve problems, what happens if my genetics were such that I wasn't gifted with an IQ of 310, and only 110? How can you how do you address that issue?
Okay, well, let me take a stab at that. I didn't quite hear the question, but behind your forehead is the prefrontal cortex, which does all the processing. That's the CEO of the brain. So if you were to ask yourself, where am I anyway? I can tell you are right behind your forehead. That is where you are. Your self-awareness, your concept of who am I, is right behind your forehead. Now, your memory, on the other hand, is located at the center of the brain, a much older part of the brain, and it's located in what's called the hippocampus. Okay? Now, the two constantly talk to each other. And so the primary characteristic of the human mind versus the animal mind is that we see the future. That is, we constantly daydream. We constantly ask ourselves the question, what if? Now, animals do not. Animals do not ask themselves, what if? Okay, they simply see day by day, instinct rules most of their life. However, sometimes the link between the center part of the brain, which governs emotions and memory, and the prefrontal cortex is broken, and then you can actually see how important it is to have memory and how important it is to have emotions. For example, when we daydream, how do we daydream? How do we see the future in our dreams? The way we daydream is by running the past over and over again. If you want to daydream about the hot date you're having tomorrow, you think about all the previous dates you had in the past or seen in the movies. That's how we extrapolate into the future by analyzing the past. And same thing with emotions. The amygdala controls emotions at the center of the brain, also very close to the hippocampus, and that's how we then have emotions. Now, in an injury, if the prefrontal cortex is separated from the amygdala, then we have a problem, and that is we have no sense of value. Everything is the same. Diamond rings, a dollar bill, important dates, important people, everything is the same because there's no emotional value attached to a diamond ring versus a dollar bill. And so we think that in the future you really need emotions, because robots without emotions will not know what is important. They'll think that a diamond ring is just as important as a dollar bill. And so we know that because of injuries to the brain, we know that the brain has to be connected to the memory or else it cannot see the future. And the brain has to be connected to the amygdala, the emotional part of the brain, or else everything has the same emotional weight. A diamond ring is the same as a dollar bill.
Oh, it's fascinating. Thank you so much for your call. Along similar lines here, Joel on email says, we may be able to upload or download knowledge to the human brain, but what about wisdom? Total Recall is a good example. He became good because of his experiences, not his memory.
Yeah, I think you hit a nail on the head, and that is it takes more than just memory to be a wise person. Except where does wisdom come from? Wisdom does not come for free. You simply cannot upload wisdom. Wisdom is a way of thinking, that is, seeing everything from not one point of view, but many, many different points of view,
yes.
And then being able to weight them. Mm-hmm. Which point of view is more important than another point of view? And that takes time. And so we will, in the future, I think, be able to upload simple memories, like learning how to drive and ride a bicycle. We'll be able to upload those memories into the hippocampus. But the wisdom of being a driver, the wisdom of being a professional, that comes from experience, because then you have to see the same thing from many points of view and then weigh the importance of each point of view.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Sandra next in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling to find out, is this pertinent to people who have dementias also, or do you need a healthy brain to have these recollections, memories?
Well, one of the most important motivators behind scientists is to treat Alzheimer's and dementia. My mother, for example, passed away because of Alzheimer's, and it was really heartbreaking to see that you can look into her eyes and she didn't recognize her own children. She didn't even know who she was. Mm. Now we know that the hippocampus, the same organ that processes memory, is the first major organ to be hit by Alzheimer's disease. You can actually see it deteriorate. So one of the motivations of the scientists who are uploading memories is to be able to upload memories into people who suffer from dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So even as their hippocampus begins to corrode with time, you can still inject memories so they know where they're located, they know who they are, they know when to come back, they're not going to get lost on the streets. That's one of the motivators behind this. And of course, even beyond that, there's schizophrenia, there's bipolar syndrome, a whole host of different kinds of diseases that we hope to one day understand and one day perhaps even cure, because we will have the Brain Project give us a map of the human brain.
We had a caller, Sandra, thanks very much for your call, who asked about autism. What are the ramifications for autism?
Well, we still don't know where autism comes from. However, we have studied the fact that a certain fraction of autistic children tend to have some kind of enhanced savant behavior. And we think that the two actually could be related. As I mentioned before, savants who have photographic memories and fantastic musical ability and artistic ability suffer some from injury to the left side of their brain. We think, though we cannot prove yet, that autism induces exactly that injury to the left part of the brain. Therefore, autism is actually the source of their enormous mathematical ability. And we think that it takes place because then the left brain, right brain balance is thrown off. The right brain, for example, is much more musical and artistic than the left brain. The left brain actually acts as a check so that we don't go off the deep end with our artistic instincts. However, if there's an injury, a very precise injury to the left side of the brain, the theory is that it allows the right brain to soar and to become super artistic. And we think that could be partially one of the origins of why these savants have these artistic abilities. Now, this has practical implications because a mild form of autism is Asperger's syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to see Asperger's syndrome, watch The Big Bang Theory on CBS television.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have some physics nerds who do seem to have Asperger's syndrome. That is, they're clueless when it comes to women. They're doormats when it comes to being on a date. And they have such hard time communicating with girls. Well, welcome to Asperger's syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we think that Isaac Newton, the greatest scientist who ever lived, who worked out the theory of gravity and mechanics, we think that he suffered from Asperger's, as well as several Nobel Prize winners.
Oh, that's fascinating. We welcome our phone calls. Our guest this hour is Michio Kaku. His latest book is The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. He's going to be at Boswell Books Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. The event is free and open to the public. I would imagine it's going to be close to a capacity crowd, so get there a little early if you can, have a cup of coffee. They'll close the doors for the duration of his speech and then open them again for the book signing. So here, did I give you the number? 800, I should know that, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. Nick in Green Bay, hi.
Hi, it's such a great pleasure to talk to you. Holy cow. My question is, I'm in school for math, and I just can't get the numbers wrapped around my head. And my question for you about it is, I take, like, disabled people for work. One guy that I take, you could ask him any type of math question, anything. Like, it doesn't matter how big it is. Within a second, he can tell you. My question is, how come he can do that? And, I mean, I'm completely fine. I'm not disabled at all. I just cannot get the math down. What's the difference? Like, you know?
Okay.
Well, this is a big mystery. I once interviewed Daniel Tammet, who has Asperger's syndrome, and he has the world's record for memorizing pi. He memorized pi to something like 15,000 digits.
Oh!
Now, I have a hard time memorizing a number to, like, you know, 10 digits, like, you know, your credit card number. And it took him about 8 hours. 8 hours with a computer program to check it. As he rattled off all the digits of pi to about 15,000 decimal places. And so I once asked him, how do you do it? He has Asperger's syndrome. He struggles to make eye contact with people. He struggles to read simple social cues like when to pause and when to laugh at a joke and how to be differential to your superiors. Things that we take for granted, he had to learn very tediously from scratch because he has Asperger's syndrome. And he said that he associates a color, a sensation for every one of the digits. And I said, well, that's nice, but how do you get 15,000 right. emotions or 15,000 colors?
Right.
And then he says he doesn't know. It just is a byproduct of his illness, he said. And he said he had a love affair with numbers. Ever since he was a child, he realized he was very good at numbers, very bad at reading emotions when you talk to somebody, very bad at that, but very good at memorizing numbers. He had a love affair. It kept him going when he got very depressed. He would just rattle off numbers in his head. Now, again, how that works, we don't know. But we think that people with this kind of ability have forgotten how to forget, that there is a subroutine that our brain understands to erase the computer tape. It takes effort to erase the computer tape. But in these individuals, that mechanism is broken. Mm-hmm. And the computer tape simply keeps on running and running and running without their permission, and they simply have this photographic memory that's been documented over and over again by psychologists.
That's fascinating. I've always thought during my lifetime, Michio, that we would make contact or somebody from another place would make contact with us, and I have no idea what the outcome would be, but I always imagined that it would be for good and that it would be a totally transformational experience for everybody involved. Considering the kinds of advances that you're talking about, and particularly consciousness moving out way out into outer space, what are the implications for being able to make contact with anything if anything is conscious and out there?
Well, I have to address the question of not just human consciousness, which tries to daydream and project into the future, but also alien consciousness and animal consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a large part of the brain is devoted to eyesight. That's how we understand our position in space and time. However, animals, like dogs, do it by smells. That a huge chunk of the dog brain is not devoted to the eyes at all.
Mm-hmm.
It smells, and they literally live in a universe of smells. If you were to brain scan a bat or a dolphin, you would find out that their ears and sonar occupies a huge portion of their brain. So if that's the consciousness of animals on the Earth, you can imagine if we make contact with consciousness from outer space, they're going to have a totally different way of assessing who they are and their place in the universe.
Yes.
However, I do suspect that if they're more intelligent than us, they will be able to run simulations into the future better than us. Think of a safecracker, for example. A safecracker may have a low IQ because they flunked out of grade school. However, they run simulations of a bank robbery much better than the police. And that's why a successful bank robber can outwit the police. If we encounter aliens in outer space, perhaps they'll be able to run simulations of the future, daydream, much better than us.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be able to run circles around us because they can anticipate scenarios that we cannot. So to me, this is the essence of intelligence, the ability not to take an IQ exam, which depends so much on society and your income, but more on the ability to see the future, which is what master criminals can do, and also, I think, what aliens in outer space will be able to do. And so when we encounter intelligent life in outer space, we have to expect that their consciousness will be much different from a dog's consciousness or a bat's consciousness, and certainly different from our visual consciousness.
Hmm. Ah. Well, let's go next to Cindy in Appleton. Hi.
Hello. Some of what you're talking about sounds like a Back to the Future movie or a show from Star Trek. And I'm just wondering, did the authors or the writers of these shows come from the future back here to write this stuff? I mean, how did they know these kind of things would be possible, you know, with what they were writing many, many years ago?
Well, first of all, everything in my book, The Future of the Mind, is based on research in the laboratory. That is, we only speculate in the last chapter when we shoot consciousness into outer space, but everything else is done on real research in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
But then you ask a question, well, where did they get their ideas? and they got many of their ideas from science fiction. And then you ask yet another question, well, where did those ideas come from? And you begin to realize that back in the 1930s and 40s, there were a lot of pulp science fiction, and people were paid to just make wild speculations independent of reality. And so people wrote about telepathy and telekinesis and uploading memories without any thought about whether they would actually be possible. The difference is that now we can take these cockamamie ideas of the pulp writers of the 30s and 40s and actually create these experiments in the laboratory and show that they were basically on the right track. And so these ideas didn't come from the future or from aliens in outer space. They basically came from very imaginative people at the very beginnings of science fiction in the pulp era back in the 30s and 40s.
Hmm. Thank you. That was an interesting question. Let's talk about our phones for a moment. You write in the book that our cell phone today, which I found incredible, has more computer power than all of NASA when it put two men on the moon in 1969. That's phenomenal. But I would imagine that, what, down the road, we will not need to use these? Will we be able to communicate in some other way? Or what's the future of the cell phone?
That's right. The cell phone today has more computer power than all of NASA in 69. And if you look at the old videotapes of going to the moon, you realize that there are 64K processors at NASA headquarters. These are dinosaur pieces. They're only found in museums now. And your cell phone has more computer power than all of that.
Mm.
Now, that's today, just in a few decades.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine what's going to happen in the next few decades, and that's when the computer basically disappears. The computer will basically communicate with the cloud. The cloud is the Internet. All the heavy lifting is done by servers in the cloud. And you'll basically walk into a room, mentally control everything in the room, adjust the lights, turn on the TV if you have one, put on music, get on the web, whatever, simply by thinking about it. That's how we're going to operate things in the future. Cars, for example, you go into a car, and you'll think, and you'll tell the car where to go, and the car will drive itself.
And that's not that far off, right?
Yeah. In fact, we have driverless cars now. They're not yet controlled by the mind, but already several states of the union have made it legal to have a driver's license for a driverless car. And so this is now science fiction impacting with science.
It sure
reality.
Is. Mike on email wonders, what would happen to our society in the future if we could upload intelligence to everyone? Who would perform jobs we need but do not require a high level of intelligence? And what laws do you think we would have to enact in this scenario?
Well, that's still a long ways to go. However, as the economy changes, requiring more and more sophisticated skills, hopefully we'll be able to upload the memories, as was mentioned, so that people can keep up with the job market. Now, in the future, intellectual capital will become more important than commodity capital. For example, foods are very essential, but the price of foods has been slowly going down for 150 years. But intellectual capital, for example, writing music or doing a Broadway show or creating a new scientific theory, intellectual capital would become more valuable into the future. And not everyone is going to be good at intellectual capital, but that's going to be the source of wealth into the future. Now, as far as robots are concerned, most of the dirty, dull, dangerous, the 3Ds, dirty, dull, dangerous jobs will be done by robots. And so things that are tedious, dangerous, will be done by mechanical devices into the future. But in my previous book, Physics of the Future, I list all the jobs that will still be with us because there are many, many areas that cannot be done with computers.
Craig is next in La Crosse. Hey, Craig.
Hi there. I was just wondering if everyone studied scientifically how one person may be intelligent as far as like book smarts, another person maybe have the ability to just have the ability to absorb street smarts. Like my beautiful wife, she can identify or memorize facts from a book, no problem. But I can memorize useless facts like how many minutes it takes the average person to fall asleep. But I can't remember names like in science class or anything like that. Has ever been studied?
Well, yes. It turns out that the old IQ of Terman, back near the turn of the century, that set the tone for intelligence exams for many, many decades, but has gradually fallen out of favor because they realized that IQ exams do measure something. They measure your ability to accumulate, you know, clerical skills, middle-class kinds of skills that are useful for society of back in 1940 or 1930. But the economy of today doesn't require those skills. And if you take a look at many of the high IQ people analyzed by Terman decades ago, follow them 30 years into the future, which is what he did, actually, many of them turned out to be petty criminals, marginally employed people, very unhappy individuals living on the margins of society. Not every so-called high IQ person became successful in life. Now, in my book, I say that the ability to see the future, that is to simulate the future, to be able to plan and to strategize and to anticipate and daydream, that is the essence of intelligence. And that's independent of whether you have these white middle-class clerical skills of 1940. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when we talk to people who are so-called dumb because they never graduated from high school, don't evaluate them on that. Evaluate them on how much they see the future in whatever profession it is. Some people are have a very active mind, are constantly running simulations into the future. And I think these are the people who get ahead. These are the people who become successful in life because they're always plotting, scheming, strategizing. That, to me, correlates more with success than with a good clerical skills.
Mm. Thank you so much, Craig, for your call. Wade in Centimore. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
All right.
Good. I was actually kind of thinking about all of this as I was driving around today. And like you're talking about how memories can be implanted. What happens, like, how would you explain it if, say, more on like the mechanical side of things, like you're going down the road and you see something happen or you anticipate the happening of something and you can just figure it out immediately and you're not really sure of how it's all happening right then and there. For instance, a few years ago, I actually got run off the road at a very high rate of speed, and by all logical thinking, my vehicle should have flipped and I shouldn't be standing here right now. But I managed to get my vehicle to spin in the right direction at just the right moments in time to keep it from spinning. And I don't really have any formal training on anything of that nature, mostly just tractor trailer stuff. But, I mean, I can anticipate what's happening in front of me when I'm on the road, and I've got, like, three or four different options that just appear to me immediately, and I can't explain it. And I think it's kind of neat, but
yeah, it is kind of neat. What is it, Dr. Kaku?
Okay, well, let me say a few things. First of all, in an emergency, time seems to slow down, so you see things in slow motion. Mm-hmm. You can actually document this. I once hosted a BBC series for British television where we took a guy, a skydiver, put him on a high platform, and then pushed him off backwards. He, of course, had a strap so he wouldn't die. But being pushed backwards, you, of course, immediately feel fear. You're being, you know, weightless for a few seconds. And then he had a timer that read numbers really fast, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. A normal person could not see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 because they flashed too quickly. But as he was thrown backwards, he could see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 light up on this little counter that he was holding in his hands. And so this is a measurable effect that in an emergency, the brain will actually speed up so that you are more conscious of what happens, like in the accident that you experience. Now, also, some people think that there's more than one dimension to intelligence. Like some people are good at gymnastics. They understand their motion in three dimensions with incredible accuracy, and they become, for example, gymnasts. Others have musical ability. And so we think that intelligence is not just a one-dimensional concept as measured by the IQ exams. There are many types of intelligences, and maybe you have one that allows you to understand motions in three dimensions. Mm-hmm. Now, we can actually see this with regards to the human brain. Male brains, for example, on average, tend to be able to manipulate objects in three dimensions better than female brains. Now, that doesn't mean that one brain is superior to another. It just means that the blood flow of the male brain and the female brain is slightly different when analyzing emotions in three dimensions.
And on that, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. You're fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, we'll look forward to seeing you in Milwaukee. Michio Kaku, The Future of the Mind. He's at Boswell Books on Wednesday of this week, and you need to get there early. Go to their website and get more information. It should be quite a night. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this show, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to Michio for, really, such a fascinating hour.